Hi there. Thanks for stopping by. Dharma Punks will be having a few events coming up. June in Philadelphia at Germantown Unitarian Society. I think it's around the 15th of June, and we will be posting the info. The dharmapunksnyc.com website. So if you're around Philadelphia in June or and feel up for that, please do stop by. Also, Labor Day, we'll be doing our annual Labor Day gathering, Garrison Institute, beautiful upstate New York. Hope to see you. So finally, if you would be capable of supporting my work, I'm a Buddhist pastor, and if you are so inclined, any little bit helps. The Venmo is Dharma Punks with an X NYC, and the PayPal and Patreon are on the website. So thanks for your support, and tonight. Going to be talking a little bit about victimization mindsets and forgiveness. So I hope tonight's talk will be of some benefit. Throughout much of human history, we tried to attain social acceptance and status by trying to fit in at all costs, concealing our differences. Wounds or traumas or losses, but pretty much anything that could set us apart was rarely disclosed, often hidden with some effort. My parents were both born right off the boat from Eastern Europe, and both took considerable efforts to hide their backgrounds, ethnic identities, changing names. My mom got speech lessons, facial work done to create an appearance that looked more in tune with what she thought the social ideal was, to assimilate, to fit in, look and sound, and to hide anything that would make us appear strange or different or even wounded, harmed. But today, there's a notable shift. A growing array of research demonstrates a shift towards claiming victimhood, seeking attention due to specifically one's trauma and suffering. Victimhood as an ego scaffolding to create an identity, not building an identity based on actions, our strengths, or our insights, but it's becoming increasingly common for people to wrap their identity around adverse childhood events, traumas from childhood, or similar very painful events. And this comes as both a blessing and a curse. Life is certainly filled with disappointing experiences. The Buddha taught in the First Noble Truth that in life, terrible events occur. Of course, there's the First Noble Truth of sickness and death and loss and being stuck with people who are scary or unpleasant. And then, of course, we can have additional really awful childhood events associated with the traumas of abuse, sexual or physical, or being with adults that are extremely emotionally dysregulated. And while most of us work with disagreeable experiences by reflecting that it's not personal, that it doesn't define us, that it's that, it doesn't consign us to a perspective on life as being victimized. There are some individuals who see themselves as the clinical term is sometimes victimhood or perpetual victims. Choose your phrase. Clinical psychologist Rahab Gabay and colleagues note that victimization mindset is an ongoing sense that one's core self is a victim across multiple, if not all, relationships in our lives. So essentially, it's this perception that creates behaviors that confirm it. That one is perennially being manipulated, taken for granted, cheated, overlooked by others. Those with perpetual victimhood very often have what's called an external locus of control. They believe that their lives are largely under the control of forces outside of themselves, especially under the control of specific individuals who are trying to harm them, or perhaps fate or some bad luck. But there's this willingness to cede one's agency, one's ability to influence one's life positively in perpetual victimhood. In fact, studies by behavioral scientist Carl Quino in this paper on signaling virtuous victimhood, victim mindset is linked directly, statistically, with narcissism and Machiavellian traits. So there's a reason for that. If you'd like to dive down, I will for you. And those of you who don't particularly care, you can just let this part blow over. But those individuals with a very damaged sense of self tend to deny their own aggressive and destructive impulses because they already feel bad enough about theirs. If they have any sense of self, they feel a sense of shame. So having any additional sense of guilt or remorse is too much to bear. So when they have any aggressive or destructive impulses, they project outwards onto other people. The other that they project onto is considered a threat. And they therefore have a sense of their self as being persecuted. Then, and when they feel persecuted, even though that confers a loss of agency and being vulnerable, they feel morally superior to others. And we'll dive into that in a second. There's a real tendency of those with perpetual victimization or victimhood to split the world into saints and monsters. They overvalue and then devalue others. They're very prone to black or white thinking. And all of this is a kind of ego scaffolding to protect their core sense of self, how they feel about themselves, their self-image. Now, I want to be clear, this doesn't in any way mean that all people who claim victimhoods have cluster B disorders or have underlying psychological disorders. I'm simply noting research that shows pretty definitively a strong correlation. I mean, these are studies of thousands of participants. It's important to note that there are individuals and groups who have experienced severe historical injustices. We could dive down to people of color, indigenous peoples of America, South America, Australia, all of whom deserve recognition, compensation of what's happened, as well as benefits to equal the playing field. And there are individuals who, of course, have experienced severe abuses in childhood, and they have every right to make that a part of their story without any doubt. It's normal, entirely normal and healthy for victims to want their perpetrators to take responsibility and express remorse. And therapists, quite frankly, frequently note that validation of abuse is important for therapeutic recovery when people finally acknowledge that they did experience some form of trauma. It's very, very healing. It provides a kind of narrative clarity that allows them to build a new story that's more accurate. But it's equally important to separate the experience of trauma and abuse with having a victimhood mindset. A victimhood mindset can, first of all, develop where no one has not experienced any unusual mistreatment. On the other hand, people who've experienced severe injustices and traumas very often wind up with zero victimhood mindset. They simply have a perspective that it's not personal, that it's their responsibility, it wasn't their fault, but it's their responsibility to establish agency, resilience, perseverance, and to be confident enough to ask for help to attain their goals. Those, though, with unhealthy victim mentalities tend to cut off others over slights or disappointments. They harbor long-standing grudges over years. They lead increasingly isolated lives. They fail to take responsibility for their actions when their actions are harmful. And most of all, they tend to recite as like the very center of their life the traumas, as if it's the traumas that give their life meaning or purpose. And the saddest outcome of this is that the recitation of abuses, whether internally is a story we tell ourselves or as something that we simply reiterate over and over again, keeps the nervous system in a state of chronic stress. The sympathetic nervous system results in high blood pressure, stroke, heart problems, so on, so forth. It's really, really not only unhealthy from any psychological perspective, but also from any health perspective. So given the dangers, and of course it does lead to isolation, because after all, people over time who've had their own traumas and wounds, but don't build a sense of self around victimization, begin over time to drift away from people who simply focus on the unfairness of their experiences. Why would anyone, what's in it? Why do people gravitate towards victim mentality? Well, another set of clinical psychologists, two women, Jordan and Kuchaki, they produced 16 studies on 10,000 people. Something like 10,000 people. Wow, it's big studies, revealing what they called a virtuous victim effect, which is a cultural tendency to see victims of wrongdoing is somehow more morally virtuous than people who aren't victims of wrongdoing. So I'll put that again. As a culture, when people are known to be victims or of wrongdoing, we tend to confer onto them a sense of moral virtuousness, which is, when you think about it, it's kind of crazy because victimhood in and of itself infers absolutely no moral value whatsoever. Victimhood, people, entirely selfish individuals can be harmed by others. People who are bullies can be harmed by others. Generally, morally, those we consider to be morally upstanding individuals are defined by their actions, not by the things that happen to them, Most of the time, we define morally upstanding individuals due to their kindness, their generosity, their trustworthiness, their unselfish. So again, in almost all areas of life, when we confer any sense of moral righteousness or confer any sense that someone is a good person, it's because they do good things. It's kind of simple, but victimhood is the what is pretty much the sole breaks that rule. In that culturally, there's a tendency, and they do all these studies where people, when told that, identical stories of two people, but you add in one person had, a crippling traumatic event, or was bullied, or was attacked, or whatever, we raise their moral evaluation, not due to any actions they've undertaken. So victimhood confers a sense of moral superiority where none necessarily exists. It doesn't mean that very many good people, there's countless of good people who've been killed, bullied, attacked, assaulted simply due to their identity, or due to the fact that they were small and could be abused. But on its own, victimhood seems to allow one to take little, if any, action and yet attain some kind of positive status. And again, when you think about it, if to use one example in history, the Catholics who were killed by loyalist paramilitary Protestant groups, and the loyalists who were killed by the IRA, both during the Troubles, neither were inherently good or bad people. The traumas and deaths that occurred didn't define who they were. Victimhood provides us a kind of, if you were, a get out of jail card free. Those who claim it as a locus of identity feel permitted to act with unchecked aggression towards those they believe have harmed or wronged them. So it's very important to claim one's negative experiences and to weave it into a story in therapy, to disclose it to loved ones. But we should not build the narrative that gives our life a sense of structure or purpose entirely around these negative experiences. A coherent, purposeful, useful narrative story includes everything and is not defined by specific events per se, which brings us to competitive victimhood, sadly. And this is very much in front of mind today and in the headlines, which occurs when two groups in conflict compete in portraying themselves as the real victim in a conflict. And people like Isaac Young and Daniel Sullivan have written a lot about this, but there's many others who write about competitive victimhood. Groups compete to be the victim as it infers a moral high ground, as we've already seen, while defining those on opposing sides as evil. And even those who take no side, who are neutral, are said to be complicit to the crimes. Victimized groups very often teach histories that focus entirely on the traumatic events that their people have experienced, rather than create a nuanced, even story that includes the time their group caused harm as well. Groups will often go back hundreds, if not thousands, of years to portray themselves as victims. Ludicrously, when I grew up during the end of the Vietnam War, when America was carpet bombing countries in Southeast Asia for really no legitimate reason at all. And at the time, there was still so much, and there still is today, so much racism and misogyny and so much homophobia, and the way our indigenous peoples have been just essentially had their own genocidal experiences at the hands of Americans who settled this land over the course of hundreds of years. America, kind of in our history books, deflected attention from all of the damaging things we were doing, not just in those areas I've listed, but the amount of horrific deaths that occurred in Central America, Guatemala, Honduras, and Chile due to our intervention, our corruption. And so we deflected attention by writing these textbooks that portrayed America as the victim of the British, and that and focusing on the Emancipation Proclamation as if it was somehow a event that defined us. In fact, we were very late as a country to liberate slaves, but we somehow, in our history books, presented as, these shining examples to deflect attention from all the harm we've done as a country. So two opposing forces can make really convincing cases that support their victimhood narratives. And conversations between supporters of these views very often deteriorate into contests over which group has suffered the most and which group has the highest moral high ground, at the expense of actually coming up to with real solutions that take care of both and ensure the safety of both peoples. Sometimes the cases aren't actually the victimization cases aren't really convincing. It's always kind of funny to hear the justifications that Putin and Russia uses for invading the Ukraine, which is a tragedy, but he blames it on the 1612 Polish-Lithuanian occupation of the Kremlin, World War II, and the fact that a couple of countries have joined NATO in the last 30 years. These are the justifications for the tens upon tens of thousands of innocent Ukrainians that have been killed by indiscriminate bombing. So, what does the Buddha say? Well, the beginning of the Dhammapada, the Buddha teaches those who harbor such thoughts as they abused me, they harmed me, they robbed me, never lose their hatred, for hatred is never ended by hatred in this world. Only by non-hatred alone, i.e., kindness, forgiveness, is hatred appeased. This is the law eternal. There are those that do not realize that one day we all must die, we all must suffer. Those who sit in their quarrels never realize this basic truth. So, before I get to Buddhist forgiveness, I'd like to note that in therapy, one goal, as I noted, should be to protect oneself against a victimhood mentality and the loss of agency and the inability to perceive kindness and helpfulness that's present in our life should be the creation of a life story that incorporates both positive and negative events that contextualize all emotional experiences and the fabric of our memories in a story that demonstrates both what we've faced and our resilience and our growth potential. And as we did last week, one should One would always benefit from a gratitude practice because the brain naturally inclines towards the negative. To it's so easy to when in the ambiguous social events that occur when people don't return our calls or messages or people forget they've made a time. It's so easy to fall in the sense that somehow it's happening to me rather than people forget they're busy, that it's not about oneself. And gratitude practice, or simply listening to other people tell their stories really alleviates this tendency. So forgiveness in Buddhist practice is letting go of reciting a story in our mind, of giving attention to a thought of, as the Buddha said, they abused me, they harmed me, they robbed me, they took advantage of me. It's simply the determination that we've given something enough thought that it's no longer protecting us in any way from it happening again. Forgiveness in the West, in sort of Catholic Christian countries, has this kind of connotation of turning the other cheek and letting bygones be bygones. It doesn't mean that in Buddhist practice, you don't drop your boundaries. You don't pretend that the other person necessarily will in any way change. And more fundamentally, from the Buddhist perspective, when someone causes harm, they're on the hook for it. They have to deal with all the karma that their actions have taken. It doesn't mean that people who practice forgiveness don't seek compensation in court or, don't take actions on their behalf, but it means there's a determination to stop ruminating on the event, to put it aside, to give, we've given it enough real estate. In holding resentment stories, we suppress the feeling of sadness that needs to be processed. Resentment is entirely by putting the locus of control externally, it diminishes the sense that we have innately, our minds have a desire to heal. And resentments provide this illusory sense that if we keep thinking about all the harm we've experienced, it'll somehow be protected. We won't drop our guard. But this actually is not true. Our brains have very fast, most of our cognitive, most of our mental functioning is unconscious, and the vast majority of the right preconscious regions of the brain are dedicated to one thing and one thing only, which is protecting us and being on the alert for something that in the past has harmed us, being on the alert and creating feelings of anxiety or fear or emotions that tell us, hey, this in the past caused us harm. So we don't have to tell a story over and over and over again in our head because there'll be a gut response that says, hold on, stop. And if we learn to listen to that feeling, it's far more effective than simply creating a victimization mindset through repeating and reciting one's wounds, one's disappointments. So in Buddhism, we start by asking for forgiveness. We bring to mind a time that we've harmed or let down someone. We hold an image in our mind of the other's face. And we even reflect on how it feels knowing that we've caused some suffering. And this is important because so much of the defenses of victimization are based on the sense one cannot feel any remorse. The more we're capable of doing it, the less we need victimization as a protection against these uncomfortable feelings. So then there's a couple of phrases we do that asks to be forgiven by those we've harmed. And we bring to mind the possibility that we can be forgiven. And then we forgive ourselves for the times we haven't shown up for ourselves. We forgive ourselves for the pain or the lack of confidence that we showed in ourselves. And we're trying to cultivate a sense of relief in the body, release of the tension that's associated with the tightness and physical smallness of perceiving oneself always at the receiving end of life's harms. And then finally, we bring to mind a time we felt mistreated, reminding ourselves that when people act harmfully, it probably means that they were suffering as well. I've never met anyone who was happy who started a fight, assaulted, abused someone. Generally, these are people deflecting their own pain. So we bring to mind the time we felt mistreated. We understand on some level that that the other person who enacted that way was suffering themselves too. And then reflecting, we offer to what degree we can some forgiveness. Again, that doesn't let them off the hook, but it means that we become willing to, we're setting an intention to drop the story. So, I hope tonight's talk was interesting in some way. I'd like to do now the practice that I described. And finally, I hope that if you're around next Tuesday and May, whatever, I think it's, is next Tuesday the first of Tuesday of, I'm not sure. I should check. I think it is. But whatever the first Tuesday of May, I hope you'll stop by at Grand Street Healing. So if next Tuesday isn't the first Tuesday of May, then, well, I'll just be back on Zoom. So let's find a comfortable seated position. And you don't have to be on screen. You can turn off your video feed, or you can just leave your video screen on, feed on, but also just lie down or sit somewhere else. I'm only saying that because some people feel understandably self-conscious meditating on screen. Frankly, I wouldn't do it if I weren't the teacher. So finding your most comfortable seated position or lying down or standing up or whatever position works for you, closing the eyes. There's a lot of reasons why closing the eyes is beneficial. It actually requires, it's energetically expensive for the brain to create ongoing images of the world around us, even though those images are largely based on pre-existing models. It's still, we're constantly checking our environment to update those models. So if you want to give your mind a rest, your brain a rest, just close the eyes. And also incline your body to a position that feels appropriate for finding ease and relaxation. So that might mean lifting up your shoulders, rotating them back and dropping them. Breathing in and bringing a kind of unforced smile or easy facial expression, and breathe out and just allow all the muscles in your face to rest. And breathing in and really expanding the belly. And then breathe out really slowly without pushing out the air. Just release the air slowly and allow your belly to release and find its most comfortable position. And this might take a couple of times. The busier, more hectic, or stressful our lives, the more our bellies can become perpetually clenched, this kind of tight, armored, defensive abdomen. So finding your breath and just trying to breathe, as the Buddha said, in a way that is conducive to both physical, emotional, and mental ease. What is a soothing breath like? Well, generally, it's one where there's no straining, gulping air on the inhalation. And there's, especially when one is relaxed, a tendency for the out-breath to be very long, unforced, smooth, soft, a gentle stream being released. When one is truly relaxed after a long day without any stress, the body regulates the brain's fight, flight, midbrain regions by long, relaxing exhalations that are parasympathetic in nature. So it's good on many for many reasons to pay attention to one's out breath. One is that the longer and the more we gently guide it, the more relaxed we become. But also people tend to drift away into stressful thoughts or sleep when they don't pay attention to their exhalations. So just really staying with the out breath until you start to breathe in again. And when people breathe in, they tend to be a little bit more alert. And we don't have to be quite as vigilant. So just think of your out breath maybe as surfing waves of energy from your chest down to your belly. I like to think of the in-breath as moving energy up from the belly to the sternum or the chest. But then as I breathe out, I tend to feel energy drifting back down. And so I ride those exhalations as a kind of wave, surfing back out. I guess that would be inappropriate. Most people surf in to the shore. But let's just sit comfortably for a while, and then we'll do the forgiveness practice. So for our forgiveness practice, I'd invite you to bring to mind a time where either intentionally or unintentionally harmed or let down someone. Without any sense of right now, any at all, any shame or guilt, just acknowledge that in life, at times we may have caused suffering. See if you can hold an image of the other's face in mind. If you can't remember what they look like or can't conjure up an image of their appearance in your mind, no worries. Just think their name. A couple of times, whisper it in your mind, and then with the phrase, knowing that I have caused harm, I ask your forgiveness. May I be forgiven? Knowing that I have caused harm, I ask your forgiveness. None of this means you or anyone else is a bad person. It simply means that there are times in life where either from either unintentionally or from rashness or stress, we don't act in ways that are in line with our kindest and most compassionate selves. And just bring to mind the possibility that all of these events can be forgiven. It's noted in the teachings that the Buddha forgave a serial killer, which doesn't mean he allowed the serial killer to have any weapons and made sure that everybody knew that this individual had committed the crimes, but he didn't parry the story as a way to define that individual. Knowing that I have caused harm, I ask your forgiveness. And if it feels helpful, putting a hand on one's heart center. When we do that, It actually confers a sense of deeper resonance. And so the next part of the practice is to forgive ourselves. No matter how much we try to show up, be our ally, take care of ourselves, there are times we treat our bodies harmfully through the food we consume or the substances people can take, or simply the lack of taking care of the body through ways that sustain it. Or sometimes we can beat up on ourselves needlessly, judging ourselves, holding impossible expectations, comparing ourselves against rarefied figures, forgetting all of the challenges that we faced. So we forgive ourselves for these times we, in essence, took ourselves for granted and didn't take care of ourselves. So hold an image of your mind, perhaps as a child or at a time in your life where you felt the most vulnerable. And we can reflect, I see and feel the pain I have experienced as a result of my own actions. To the extent I can, now I forgive myself. Once again, I see and feel the pain and suffering I've caused myself. And to the extent I can, I forgive myself. And finally, releasing the people who've committed harm from our ruminations and thoughts. Bring to mind a time you felt mistreated. And even though it seems hard at times to accept, but if you can remind yourself that the other person to have acted this way must have been suffering in some way themselves, either way, even if that doesn't work for you, remembering that reciting their actions in no way protects us. It only keeps us locked into a very damaging mindset. So, holding their image in mind, I see and feel the pain you've caused. And to the extent I can right now, it's my intention to forgive you. I see and feel the pain you've caused. It's my intention. To the extent I can right now, it's my intention to forgive you. This doesn't let anyone off the hook. We all live with our own karma. But keeping reciting stories is not a healthy way to recover. And so when you're ready, just letting this practice fade, taking a nice full in-breath, slowly opening your eyes, and when you feel ready, return to the class.